Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable everyday terms for just regular folks. Our end goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today we're going to give a post-election status update on Trump's legal cases, both civil and criminal. We'll tell you where each case currently stands after the election and talk about what to expect next. Judge Gail, the election has thrown a monkey wrench in all kinds of cases. It has impacted, I think, every single Trump case, and there is a lot of them out there. There are a lot of them out there, I should say. Mm-hmm. I think we ought to sort of just go through one by one and talk about the ramifications. Obviously, the election has just really changed the legal landscape here.
It has. And I think what it underscores is that this, again, is just territory we've never been in before. Certainly, circumstances that the framers never contemplated, and that as a democratic society, we've never had to navigate. So all of this is very unique. And it's also interesting. So for us legal geeks, we're clearly interested in seeing how this works. And certainly for us, you know, retired judges, we are deeply interested in how our colleagues kind of, you know, navigate this labyrinth of this legal quagmire this former president is in. And I'm really interested to see how it turns out from a more, you know, pedestrian standpoint, a layperson standpoint. I think you still have those who desire to see accountability. They want to know that the system does work, but it works fairly for everyone. And what does fairness mean, right? What does it look like? Does it mean that, sure, you know, if you're facing criminal charges, the next thing you should do is launch a presidential campaign? I don't know. But I think there are going to be some questions that certainly need to be answered to every other person in society, given what we are experiencing, right? And we're going to owe some folks some answers, because there's some average John Q. Publics out there who will never become president of the United States. And yet, you know, they will face dealings with the criminal justice system for which there is no escape hatch. Or perceived escape hatch. And I think that's certainly a worthy conversation to have.
And when things move against them in lightning speed, where things moved in these cases at less than a snail's pace.
Less than, my Southern mama would say, as slow as molasses in the wintertime.
There you go. What I want to do is I'm going to take each case and sort of give a real brief summary of where I think we are, but then I'm going to talk about it. And let me start off with saying I'm glad I'm not any of these judges, because these are total no-win situations for these judges.
Yeah.
And as you said, they're plowing new legal ground on many cases, dealing with things that they've never had to deal with before, and under a microscope with everybody looking at them, legal scholars as well as just ordinary citizens. So let's start off with the case in Washington, D.C., the federal criminal case on the what's been called the election interference case with Judge Tanya Chutkan. To give you just our audience just a brief recap, recall that this case was put on hold, and then on July 1st, the United States Supreme Court came out with a decision on presidential immunity, basically giving presidents immunity for any official acts. Those that are borderline, there's presumptive immunity, and the burden then is on the government to take away that immunity. So that was issued by the Supreme Court on July 1st. It came back to Judge Chutkan with very little instruction from the Supreme Court on how to interpret the cases before her. So to make it simpler, Special Prosecutor Jack Smith came up with what we have called and what is called a superseding indictment, basically taking away some of those indictments that or counts that he thought were covered by the Supreme Court decision and paring it down to four felonies that he thought could survive. Judge Chutkan was debating what to do with that, had not issued a decision on whether or not those could go forward under the immunity guidelines of the Supreme Court. Right after the election, however, on November 8th, Judge Chutkan came out with a new order suspending all deadlines in the case, just basically saying, we're going to put this sucker on hold. But issued one new deadline, and that is of December 2nd, and said that the prosecutors, Jack Smith and his team, have to come forward to the court to say how they want to proceed now that Trump is elected president. Is that an accurate summary?
Absolutely. And not only is it accurate, I think it is anticipatory, right? It's something that, you know, no matter where you fall on this political spectrum, you would have been foolish to not have anticipated that this could have been an outcome, or this could have been the position that we would find ourselves in. Obviously, with two candidates running for president, you're going to have a winner and you're going to have a first runner up, or, you know, in some circles it's called first place loser. But yes, but you certainly will have someone who wins and someone who does not. And given the fact that there was at least the likelihood that this could happen, I believe you and I touched on this before, you know, there has to be a game plan for what you do in the event that this happens, and lo and behold, it does. And so what you've summarized is certainly exactly what, not only what took place, but certainly what has been the actions of the court in response to what's taken place, which I think were fairly swift and also really thoughtful. Consider the fact that, you know, obviously, you know, things may have moved differently if there were a different outcome. And now that there isn't, this, again, swings us back. If we thought we were in new territory, Judge, when we faced a former president being indicted in the first place, or being charged criminally being charged, you know, tried civilly, if we thought all of that was new territory, oh my gosh, welcome to Wonderland.
Yeah.
Because this is, we don't have anything in the pages of history that I'm aware of. And I won't suggest that I am, you know, the history aficionado, but I will tell you, I don't believe there is anything in the pages of history that can even give us a basic outline of where we go with this. No. And I'll tell you what my first thought was as a prosecutor, right? And so you can chime in as a defense attorney. My first thought right after the election results were called by all the major networks is, as a prosecutor, I'm always thinking about speedy trial. And speedy trial for our listeners is the time or the amount of time that a prosecutor is given under law to bring a case to trial before it is required to be dismissed, because every defendant is entitled to what's called a speedy trial. It is a clause within the United States Constitution. It is recognized and embraced by, you know, every jurisdiction in every state, and the clock or the amount of time that is provided for a speedy trial is pretty basic, but it differs from state to state and jurisdiction to jurisdiction. It even differs from case to case. And for example, one difference can be maybe the clock is longer for a defendant that's charged with an offense, but is out on bond and is sharing the community while their case is pending, versus a defendant whose freedom has been limited with incarceration while they are awaiting trial. And therefore, the standard or the definition or the requirement for ensuring that they get a speedy trial is quicker or faster than someone whose freedom has not been affected by their pending case. And so the time on the clock, if you will, the time that's granted for a defendant to bring that case may differ. And that's only one example of how speedy trial can affect one case or another. There are some other elements, but my mind immediately went to the speedy trial clock. And what does it mean for speedy trial? Because as you said, Judge, you know, the wheels of justice rolled a little bit slower in these cases then we've probably seen them in other cases. And John Q. Public is probably sitting in their house or barbershop or somewhere saying, "My, I wish my case was this slow, or I wish I had these many appeals, or I wish I could go through these many hurdles, or I wish I could take it up to the U.S. Supreme Court and almost guarantee that my case would be heard." And that doesn't happen. And so I immediately said, freeze the clock. That was the first thing that came to my mind, which was, yeah, preserve your clock. Preserve whatever time you have. If in fact, as a prosecutor, you want to zealously advocate for this case, you know it's not likely to happen during this presidency. And so instantly I started thinking, I think most strategically as a prosecutor, I would dismiss the charges. I would preserve whatever time is remaining on the speedy trial clock. And given that federal judges serve for a lifetime, it's very likely that the same judge would be there, you know, after this term of presidency is over. And if there's time left, then revive the case then. And this happens often when prosecutors need to investigate more.
Yeah, let me jump in here, because there are really two time periods that we're talking about here so that our listeners understand and don't get confused. There's what's called a statute of limitations, which is how long a prosecutor has to bring a charge against somebody from the incident. The incident takes place, and then there's a period of time. And if the prosecutor does not bring a case within that period of time, then they're barred from doing it. It's called a statute of limitations. That's different than speedy trial. Speedy trial takes place once the charge has been filed, once the indictment has come down and the person is targeted as a defendant. Then there is a specified period of time in which that case has to come to trial. However, the defense, by filing motions or appeals or anything that might delay the case, extends the speedy trial because of the actions of the defense. It gives the prosecutor a longer time. However, it's still a relevant factor, as Judge Gale pointed out, in a case such as this. Now, Judge Gale, Jack Smith has been talking in the media that he plans to resign, he and most of his staff, I think, before Trump takes office as president. With that being the case, I would expect on the December 2nd deadline and how he's going to proceed, that he would proceed to dismiss the indictments. Now, there are two kinds of dismissals. There's a dismissal with prejudice and a dismissal without prejudice.
Indeed.
Can you talk about those a bit?
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I was speaking to. I feel like you were right there inside my brain. And thank you always for perfectly articulating what my thoughts were. But indeed, there are two types of dismissals that are recognized in criminal cases. A dismissal with prejudice is a dismissal that signals to the court, to the defendant, and to all the parties that the state is, by dismissing the case, abdicating, relinquishing, or abandoning or giving up its right to ever bring the case back. So if you think about the case being, you know, perhaps sitting on a desk in a room, and by dismissing it with prejudice, not only do you close the door to that room, you are welding it shut so that it cannot be reopened. It is a bar.
Not even locking it, welding it shut.
No, not even locking it. It is literally like welding the door shut so that you cannot re-access that case. You cannot go back to it. Now, this is different from starting a trial and there being certain attachments that take place once a jury is seated. That's not the same as double jeopardy. Double jeopardy also means that a prosecution cannot bring a case back once they have begun it, but it is not the same as dismissing it. Dismissals are voluntary, meaning it comes by way of a motion, which is really just the legal term for a request. And so the prosecution generally makes a motion. Sometimes the defense can make a motion or ask the court to dismiss a case with prejudice as well, but the state or the government can do it on their own. And so it's not a request that's limited to one side of the room or another. Also, the court itself can also make a finding or a ruling that dismisses a case with prejudice, depending upon what the outcome of certain case information is or has been. But in this instance, as you speak to it, Judge, the dismissal with prejudice would likely come from the prosecution against their own case, if that's what they're looking to do. Alternatively, meaning they could ask to dismiss the case and set it in that room, weld the door shut, and never access this case again, meaning they can never come against this defendant for this charge, for these reasons, under these circumstances, ever again. It has been dismissed with prejudice. The alternative is to request what's called a dismissal without prejudice. And so, as you could imagine, this kind of works similarly, but not identical to a dismissal with prejudice. When a prosecution or defense or even the court issues an order to dismiss a case without prejudice, that means it preserves or reserves the right of the prosecution to bring the case back at a later time, as long as the case has not expired under the Speedy Trial statute. Because if, in fact, the case has expired, meaning there is no time, no legal or statutory time remaining to bring the case forward, then even if there is a dismissal without prejudice, that case is still dead. It does not have the requisite amount of time to bring it back, and therefore it cannot be brought back. And so comparing it to a dismissal with prejudice, this would be like taking the case file, setting it on a desk in a room with a door and actually shutting the door and locking it so that it cannot be immediately accessible. So you lock the door and the case is on the other side. But with a dismissal without prejudice, there is the ability to unlock the door at some time in the future.
You still have the key. You still have the key.
And recover that case and bring it back.
And that's what I anticipate will happen in this case. There is one last thing before we move on this case. And that is, Judge, I think that you and I are in total agreement that the Supreme Court of the United States gave Judge Chutkan a really large order in having her flesh out the standards that courts would consider on presidential immunity.
I think large order is one thing. Raw deal is closer to the truth.
Well, they were expecting her to do that, and then they would review it, and presumptively they would review it and fine-tune it, or find that she was wrong, or amplify more on their immunity decision. Now, if the case is dismissed, she will not issue that decision. So the Supreme Court's decision that lacked definition will be hanging out there without any lower court interpretation. And I think that can complicate things in the future.
You're absolutely right. And here's another layer of complication. When we have Supreme Court cases that lack the clarity, the standards, what we usually call a test, that is embedded in the language of the opinion, which is also known as the Latin term dicta. When we have a Supreme Court opinion like this one,
you're so good on that Latin. Go ahead.
That had none of these things. It had none of these elements. What it also, because of the uniqueness of this case, it also means we will not have resolution in another case to compare it to, because it is so very unique. The United States only has one president at a time. And therefore, you don't have another, unless what you are looking at, and I don't know that this is outside the realm of possibility, but unless what you're looking at is potentially an indictment of Joe Biden once he leaves office, you have absolutely no precedent and no similar case upon which to test these theories or this order from the United States Supreme Court. Because it would have meandered or gone through so many layers of appeal after Judge Chutkan, because what I am willing to bet is that after Judge Chutkan ruled, no matter how she had ruled on the issue of immunity, that ruling was going to be sent then to the Court of Appeals. And depending upon, well, not even depending upon, no matter the ruling out of the Court of Appeals, there was going to be one side or another that was going to be unhappy. And then that would then be appealed to the United States Supreme Court, which,
by the
way, we
presume the court would have taken it because of the uniqueness of the issue.
And which is one of the standards that the court has to consider when deciding whether or not it will grant a hearing or what's called certiorari. It will decide that those constitutional issues and also the uniqueness of it. And this, of course, as it relates to the highest office in the land, the president of the United States, that certainly fits the bill. And I don't doubt for 3 seconds that they would have taken this case. After all, they'd taken just about every other case relative to the former president, now soon to be president again. They'd taken every other case that he had been involved in, so as to provide that unique guidance on what to do with these particular matters. And so we could presume that something similar would happen. In this instance, when you have Judge Chutkan now unable to even create the standards, the test, or the elements that would have been born out of this hearing on immunity, we now would have to either wait until this upcoming presidential administration has concluded to return to whether or not we'll get an answer on this, or maybe, possibly, I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility, see if the currently sitting president, who will now become the former president come January, if he faces something similar that would then call upon the same application of these same rulings in any charges that he might face. And again, this is all possible given the climate of things. It is not, I think we would be foolish to not consider the fact that this is at least a potentiality. I don't know how remote, but we may see this come back again. And if not Judge Chutkan, then someone else may be required to make these same determinations.
Let me just summarize here. It's like going on a road trip to a destination you've never been without any kind of map or GPS system. Isn't that right?
And not even a bird, a flock of birds that can form an arrow in the sky to tell you go this way. That would be helpful if you just...
It sure would.
You just had a flock of birds, but you don't have anything. You don't have smoke signals. It would be, maybe back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s when you could stop at a service station and they would sell maps of a particular area and you'd have to maybe pull to the side of the road to get a sense of where you were to know where you were going. Or imagine doing that and you walk in a service station and there are no maps. There's nothing. Just nothing, and the clerk.
Nobody's
just
ever heard of where you're going either, so they can't give you directions.
You'll do good to get to the next town over if there. But that is exactly what you've described. Is literally the definition of no man's land. You have no idea where you're going. You don't know how to get there. You are doing the best you can, and you kind of hope that maybe it turns out okay, but you don't have any guidance. And that's unfortunate, but I think that's kind of the best analogy we could come up with.
Let's move on. We've got a lot of cases to cover in the next half hour or so. So the federal case in Florida, Judge Aileen Cannon dismissed that case, saying that Jack Smith was improperly appointed. And as we have talked before, she basically followed the lead of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and his concurring opinion on the immunity case.
And it's uninvited. It was uninvited.
Yeah, right. It was. So after that ruling, Jack Smith appealed that case to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. I'm sorry. And the appeal is sitting there. So it is unlikely to proceed prior to Trump taking office. We assume that appeal will be dismissed. But what that leaves us, Judge, is a lower court conflict. Most of the lower courts have upheld the appointment of special counsel or special prosecutor in this case. Judge Cannon was the outlier on this, but those cases, if it gets dismissed and we don't have an appellate decision, that'll leave a conflict and sort of a gray, unknown area in the law surrounding special counsel.
You're absolutely right. And consider the fact, and I keep going back to this because I just think of the likelihood of it, consider the fact that in the next 4 years, there could very well be a higher than average probability that we will see special counsel appointments, right? And that we will see this kind of activity out of the U.S. Department of Justice. And if that is in fact the case, the argument, quite frankly, to our listeners is something that we've probably heard many times as young people, right? What's good for the goose is good for the gander. And if the appointment of special counsel has been a longstanding upheld practice that had not been challenged up until now, with, as you said, Judge Aileen Cannon being the only outlier. All it takes is one opinion to kind of, set things kind of in motion in a direction that had not existed before. then imagine what we may be facing in the coming years. Because again, I think it's highly likely that we'll see the appointment of special counsel, and that that appointment of special counsel is very likely to be consistent with the majority opinion that has been upheld by trial courts, saying that the process as used before was perfectly fine, with the exception, again, of Judge Cannon's 100-page opinion that kind of embedded in all of this the ruling that Special Counsel Jack Smith was improperly appointed, which again was, you know, kind of an uninvited decision because it wasn't even something that the prosecution even argued at the U.S. Supreme Court, because it wasn't an issue that was raised. At first, it was uninvited by Justice Thomas, and then it was adopted by Judge Cannon, all of which in a process that denied at least one side, actually both sides, because neither the prosecutor nor the defense argued this point to the Supreme Court. And although it was raised with Judge Cannon, that was not the heart of the issue or the appeal that went to the Supreme Court. That was not it. And so this was completely uninvited. And I think we're going to see it again when we see other cases that come out of the DOJ, and these other cases coming out of DOJ that seek to appoint special counsel that will not have had a, as you said, resolution to this issue as to what a proper appointment is now that you have one outlier opinion. And I think you're going to have broad adoption of whatever the process was that's already in existence. I don't think you're going to see a new process that appoints special counsel because of Judge Cannon's opinion. You're not going to see that. And you're going to have somebody crying foul on the other side, and rightfully so.
Simply put, the script is going to be flipped on the Trump administration. The Trump team argued that Jack Smith was not properly appointed because he did not receive Senate confirmation. I cannot imagine a Trump Justice Department wanting to go to the Senate to get confirmation on a special prosecutor that they've handpicked to go after one of the political enemies of President Trump. So
get it now that you have the majority. I mean, now that he has the trifecta.
But he won't want to even do that. You know, so
and I think you're absolutely right. And the reason why I think he won't want to do that is that for someone, I believe, who sees themselves as fairly supreme, this would mean he has to perhaps acquiesce some power or authority.
He's not going to want to do that
to another body of government. And I just don't know that that's the personality. I mean, I think that if he felt like it were required, like consulting them on the budget, et cetera, then maybe. But when it comes to doing something that takes us as far back as Watergate and before, where this has never been the process. In fact, I think this was just a completely manufactured response by Justice Thomas, because there's never been a time in American jurisprudence that a special counsel has required Senate confirmation in order to proceed with their work. And I invite anyone to correct me if I'm wrong, but I am not aware of a single time when this has been the reality. And I think Justice Thomas is a smart enough man to know that as well. But this was created out of whole cloth to, you know, create and to establish a new standard almost exclusively or singularly for Prosecutor Smith, where it had not existed before. And that's, again, where you're going to, and I think rightfully so, you're going to get pushback, because if the law requires nothing, it requires the fair application of rules across the board. It requires that what is applied to one applies to all, but not applied to some to the exclusion of others. And that's, I think, what's problematic here.
Okay. I want to jump in and wrap up our federal case segment here by talking about Jack Smith could give, even if he dismisses all the cases, he could give a report to Attorney General Merrick Garland detailing the findings of both probes, the Florida confidential document case and the election interference case in Washington. Originally, Merrick Garland said that if he received that, he would make it public. I'm not sure that he would do that at this point. I'm not sure what good that would do, but do you see that as sort of a way to summarize all this from Jack Smith's perspective? And I give you 30 seconds to give me an answer.
I think he could do it. I agree with you. I don't know that he would. I don't know that there's an appetite to release it if he did. And there's always that open-ended question of to what end or for what benefit would it be? Certainly, I think there's very little that could be borne out in a report that most people who were part of the voting electorate didn't know or already suspect. And notwithstanding that, the outcome was what it was. So is it for a legal benefit? Is it for a public benefit? Is it, hey, we just want to let you guys know that this is what you got? Well, people know what they got and they voted for what they got. And so that's not, had it come out before, it would have been perceived as election interference.
And now, it's different than the Mueller report, because the Mueller report was antecedent to indictments and there were no indictments.
Correct.
Here we've had the indictments and then you get the report. It's almost anticlimactic.
And you're like, thanks for nothing at this juncture. Appreciate it. Thanks for nothing. And you know, here, I have a question for you as we wrap this up, because we were talking about dismissals with and without prejudice.
Yeah.
And so why don't we talk a little bit, or can you tell our audience a bit about what the power of the incoming attorney general could be, even if there is perhaps a motion by Jack Smith to dismiss the matters without prejudice, and whether or not a new attorney general could say, no, we want to dismiss them with prejudice.
I think the new attorney general could make that argument. I'm not sure how receptive Judge Chutkan would be to that argument. I assume that the new one would make it, but as long as that new attorney general's in power for 4 years, I don't think that they're going to do it. My view is that if it's dismissed without prejudice, there would still have to be a new indictment to come forward from a grand jury, and that's not going to happen.
So that would be an interesting strategy. And follow me on this, is if you had Prosecutor Smith dismiss the matter without prejudice to the chagrin of whoever the new attorney general is. It seems that the electorate has a broad appetite for, I guess, theatrics. So they'll go through this song and dance no matter what. And so if there's a dismissal without prejudice and you've got a new attorney general that says, you know what, Mr. President, we just want to make sure you don't ever have to deal with this ever again. This is going to be and look a little painful, but just go with us on this. And so Judge Chutkan won't let us dismiss it with prejudice. The court won't grant that. We're going to reindict you and then we're going to dismiss it with prejudice.
Yeah, they're not going to reindict the president.
I don't think so. I think that takes a bit of a leap. That's a bit of a leap.
I think they'll just leave that door locked and maybe hide the key so nobody can find it.
Yeah, cross fingers to the point of breaking.
There you go. There you go. Let's move on to state cases. You and I both were state trial judges, and we've got some state trial judges in the midst of just judicial hell. Let's start with Georgia. If you recall, there were multiple RICO indictments brought by Fani Willis, the attorney in the prosecuting attorney in Fulton County, Georgia. There were all kinds of issues about whether or not she should be disqualified for conflict of interest with a romantic relationship with a special prosecutor that she appointed, and some financial conflicts of interest. Judge Scott McAfee, young judge in Georgia, denied a bid to disqualify Willis. However, the Trump people appealed, and that case is before the Georgia Court of Appeals. And since the election, the court has indefinitely suspended the case and canceled oral arguments that were previously scheduled. So that's where that case stands. On November 20th, the Court of Appeals canceled oral arguments. So what does this mean, Judge? And in particular, I want us to talk about what this means for the other defendants. There are 14 remaining defendants other than President Donald Trump. Does this put the case on hold for all of these? If you recall, just a couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court of the United States denied Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff of the president, his request to move the case to federal court, leaving it in state court. If Fannie Willis or her successor could decide to go forward with the other cases and leave Trump out, but the court of appeals just suspending the case really throws a monkey wrench in all of this.
Indeed it does. And pardon me, one thing I think we should consider is the fact that, as you say, there are multiple defendants in this case. So it's not just one person's case that's impacted.
There were 18 originally and 4 already entered pleas of guilty. So there are 14 remaining.
And so what I think is worthy of consideration is the fact that you're right, this has a windfall effect, which is it means it's going to affect all 14 remaining defendants. And again, for better or for worse. And for now, they're probably feeling for better because, you know, if they get the same benefit that of holding the case up or nothing happening to it, then those other 13 defendants are just as happy. Maybe they are. Maybe they want resolution. So, but they're probably happy at least for the time being because it gives them an opportunity or more time to strategize. What I think, however, is that as it relates to the other 13 defendants, save President-elect Trump, the other 13 defendants, their cases actually should go forward, and or they could resolve with pleas, right? The matter that's before the Georgia Supreme Court is as it relates to Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis.
Yeah, it's in front of the Court of Appeals, not the Supreme Court yet.
You're right, the Court of Appeals. Yeah. And so what I think that they could ask for is a mandamus or a mandate for the court to rule at least on the remaining 13 so as not to delay proceeding with those matters and potentially maybe even getting more pleas or getting more of the case resolved, which may not be a bad strategy. Remember that D.A. Willis was just reelected. Her term of office is 4 years, just like President Trump's. And so should she decide to and is successful in running again after this 4 years, she could spend the next 4 years patting her foot, just waiting for the time to go by on defendant Trump's matter while pushing the appellate court to allow her office to proceed on the remaining 13 defendants, because remember, they do not enjoy the same immunity that has been argued on behalf of President-elect Trump. And because they don't, there certainly has to be some argument made as to the reasonableness of delaying the resolution of those cases. And what is required is that a fair trial is given, not just to the defendant, but also to the state. And the state could absolutely argue, and maybe they will, that this works as an impediment and a detriment to the state putting on a new trial where their responsibility is to protect and guard the citizenry. And so there are far more folks affected by them not being able to proceed than even the 13 defendants, remaining defendants whose cases are not yet resolved. And so I could absolutely see, or I would not be surprised if an argument like that was forthcoming, because I think it would be timely. It would also continue to kind of sharpen the knives, if you will, for potentially the eventuality of prosecuting President-elect Trump after this four-year term and being prepared. Because remember, and as we've talked about it before, states are sovereign when it comes to imposing or executing the laws of their land. And so they are not beholden to the decisions of a Judge Cannon or Judge Chutkan or any other judge. They are absolutely sovereign and have the right to proceed forward. And although they recognize the authority of the federal government, the states don't have to withhold or bar themselves from proceeding with prosecuting even a sitting president. That is not a requirement. And in fact, even in DOJ, that's not the law. It is really more of a policy articulation than anything, but the states are not bound by that.
Right. But let me jump in here. If they were to go forward against President Trump, there would be the presidential immunity questions. And poor Judge Scott McAfee, sitting in the same place that you and I sat, mm-hmm. would have to come up with what we have previously discussed, Judge Chutkan was to come up with, and that would be the guidelines or the steps to be considered on presidential immunity. So that probably will remain on hold. To go forward against the other defendants would not have the Judge McAfee would not need to address the presidential immunity question. He would have other questions on privilege and so forth, but he would not have to address the presidential immunity questions. But by the State Court of Appeals putting this on hold, it just makes the quagmire even more murky, in my idea.
I don't disagree, which is why I think the tool, at least available to the state of Georgia, would be requesting a mandamus or a mandate from the Supreme Court to the appellate court to say, rule on this on these important issues so that the state can prepare to, you know, faithfully execute the laws of Georgia. That's not unreasonable. Now, whether or not the Supreme Court will do that is another question, but I don't know that that has been asked of them. I think from a strategic standpoint and even from a legal standpoint, it would not be improper to ask that. And in fact, it would be necessary so that they could get their arms around it. But to your point about Judge McAfee needing to deal with the immunity question, all of a sudden now the issue of immunity and the test that's used to determine it seems like the hot potato on the bench.
And it's back down to a state trial judge.
Indeed. It's like, wait a minute, you know, how did this hot potato land here? It was up in, you know, D.C. and now it's bounced all the way to Georgia.
With the feds and, you know, yeah. I just got reelected and I don't want to deal with this.
Exactly. And I think Judge McAfee has handled himself very well.
He has.
In this arena, it can feel like, well, we know how it feels like to be a jurist, right? Yeah. It's stressful. It can feel like you're in a fishbowl.
But the spotlight of the nation is on him right
the
now.
The entire nation. And so he, again, I think has handled this. I think he's handled it well, all things considered, and he's been really thoughtful in his responses. But I think this goes back to our point that we made maybe in very early on podcast episodes, which is, by and large, judges are not beholden to political affiliation. We are governed by the rule of law, and we make decisions and determinations based on that rule of law, without respect or regard to party affiliation. I think there are those who are deep inside of political parties who want or would rather or seem to engage in pressure campaigns for judges to rule consistent with party affiliation when it's beneficial. But I think the good judges, the best ones among us, reject that wholesale. And we do what needs to be done without regard to that.
I want to move on to the New York case because it's fascinating as well. If our listeners recall, Donald Trump was convicted, or excuse me, a jury came back with findings of guilty against him on 34 felonies that occurred in May. His sentencing has been postponed at least a couple of times. Then Judge Juan Merchan moved the sentencing to this week, as a matter of fact. And he did that earlier. Since the election, however, Judge Merchan on November 22nd issued a order indefinitely postponing Trump's sentencing. And we don't know whether that means to some later time prior to Trump taking office, or whether it could even be after Trump takes office.
Out of office.
So the part of that ruling, though, that I think has been missed by the media is that Judge Merchan also is allowing Trump's lawyers to make a new set of immunity, presidential immunity, going back to that July 1st Supreme Court ruling, immunity-related arguments against his conviction. And we had talked about this earlier, that there were a lot of evidentiary issues before Judge Merchan, and whether or not that evidence tipped the scale to guilty, whether it should be a mistrial, all kinds of decisions. But Judge Merchan is letting Trump's lawyers file that. They have until December 2nd to file that, and the prosecutors then have till December 9th to reply. You know, being a former criminal defense attorney, besides being a judge, if I had a client convicted in May and we're approaching the end of November and no sentence has taken place, I'd say win, win, win. That just doesn't happen.
It doesn't. It does not. I'm not aware. So we're back to, this is all new to us. We are not accustomed to seeing this type of behavior in the criminal justice system. And I'm not suggesting that it's untoward or that it's inappropriate. I'm just saying that it is unique because of the party involved. So I agree. What I think concerns me is the fact that, yes, there was a trial. The jury was seated. They heard evidence and information. I believe Judge Merchan was already tasked previously through motion practice with determining whether or not certain testimony that may have or could have been excluded based on the U.S. Supreme Court's immunity decision, whether or not that the inclusion of that testimony or that evidence was so detrimental or so impactful that it should result in vacating the finding of guilt by the jury. And I believe that he's already, or if I'm correct, he may have already decided on that very narrow issue. The fact that the defense is being invited to kind of raise this again does give me a bit of concern, and concern only to this point, because I think you said it best when you said, I know that I would not want to be in any one of these judges' shoes. I do not envy them, not one bit. But what concerns me, again, is how something more basic like public perception of the justice system is going to shake out after this. We've been really careful to resist referring to President-elect Trump as being convicted because, in my view, and I stand by this, no conviction is a conviction without a sentence. And notwithstanding the jury returning verdicts of guilty on all 34 counts, he's still not been sentenced. And therefore, as I interpret the definition of conviction, he cannot be considered convicted
Despite what the media says.
Despite the language they use. I just don't think they know how to term it, right?
Yeah. They say he's first convicted felon. And that's not totally accurate.
That is not completely accurate. What he has been is he has been found guilty by a jury
of felonies.
Of 34 felonies. And that is true. And maybe it's because that's not a soundbite. Maybe it's because you can't just say that in one word and then, you know, trigger some basic pedantic understanding from your audience. But what we have to be is we have to be very careful in our word choice, in our language, in our use of legal terms, because we can, in fact, persuade the public into believing one thing when it's not, again, in my view, entirely accurate.
He's been found guilty of 34 felonies. He has not been convicted.
He has not been convicted.
Because he has not been sentenced.
No conviction is a conviction without a sentence. And that is exactly the step that strategically, and again, rightfully so, all things considered, that is what his President-elect Trump's attorneys are fighting most vigorously for, is to keep that conviction from attaching. And to basically walk back everything that's happened. So with that being said, yes, there's some legal maneuvering. But the flip side of that is, how do we explain this to the public? How do we explain this to people we expect to abide by the rules in a civil society and to tell them that there are consequences for their actions, legal consequences that include prosecution for criminal matters? How do we explain that to them? And expect to continue to have a society where we all agree that in order for it to work, we got to abide generally by the same rules, when we know, or we're seeing, or we're believing that the rules don't apply. Now, we may have always believed that the rules don't apply the same to everybody, but to see it in such brazen form is, again, something I would not trade my seat for Judge Marchand's right now. I think that is a heavy lift. I think it is, you know, something that's concerning, because you and I both know that the judiciary struggles and suffers from having low approval ratings with the Supreme Court all the way down to your local traffic court and everything in between. Every court is suffering from lack of faith in the justice system, and by and large because of judges. And I'm not sure how you rebound from this. Even with us explaining all of these legal tools that are available both to the prosecution and the defense.
Let me jump in and finalize this part in the New York case, and that is, if Judge Marchand did sentence President Trump before he takes office on January 20th, obviously the president would not be able to conduct his punishment, whether it's
from Rikers,
whether it's prison or anything, or probation or house arrest or whatever it is. So that would not happen. So Judge Marchand could sentence him, and then what we would call stay the imposition of sentence, or put it off until after Trump leaves office, or Judge Marchand could just punt and say, I'll sentence you after you leave office, and we'll address it then. That's a big question mark. But right now, as we sit here, 34 felonies with guilty pleas, no sentencing, therefore no convictions.
Guilty findings. You're absolutely right. And I absolutely agree with you on what the options are for Judge Marchand. And quite frankly, I think either of those would be palatable to at least to the prosecution and the general public. Now, obviously, to the defense, it would not be. But again, I think that in order to preserve the legacy and the legitimacy of the rule of law, my opinion is one or the other of those options you outlined would be most optimal.
All right. We've got about 5 minutes to cover the civil cases, so let's run through them quickly.
Money. That's all I know.
Right now, there are 3 civil judgments against Donald Trump and a 4th serious civil case still pending. There is the fraud case that, you recall, Manhattan Judge Arthur Engoron imposed a $450 million penalty judgment against Trump, saying he fraudulently inflated his net worth. The Court of Appeals has heard, Trump's attorneys appealed that. Court of Appeals has heard oral arguments in September on that. Most legal analysts say that they had a skeptical eye on the ruling of Judge Engoron as maybe being excessive. So that one is still pending. We'll see how that goes. There are the Jean Carroll cases. Trump owes $88 million in judgments on two cases, one that he sexually abused her. This was a civil finding, and that he defamed her afterwards. These are also under the appeal to the Court of Appeals in New York. There are eight other cases pending, civil cases, about January 6th. One is a major case about Trump's role in the January 6th riot. Police officers were injured. They sued Trump for damages. That one is unresolved. And then we also have Trump bringing several cases against news media and reporters. So the overarching question, Judge, is, on these civil cases, can they go forward? Can judgments be rendered? Can they be enforced against a sitting president? Where do we stand on the civil matters?
Now, see, in my view, I think the civil matters should not be held up. These are all what we call pocketbook cases. They are about and involve money. And many of them, as you've outlined, have already been resolved. So the judgments have been issued. And quite frankly, you know, I don't think that President-elect Trump is hurting for cash. These are, I mean, you know, when your new best friend is, you know, a tech Elon billionaire, right? So, I mean, this is like lunch money for these guys. And even if you don't get it from your friends, apparently your campaign is willing to raise money to pay at least for your attorney fees. So I'm not sure why they wouldn't pay for your judgments. So these things, I think, again, can be easily resolved. I am more concerned about the push against the media. What are your thoughts?
Well, I want to see whether or not the courts will allow those to go forward. You know, historically, civil cases have not been impacted by the Department of Justice rule that somebody can't attack a president while they're sitting in office. In fact, when Trump was president before, he was forced to pay a judgment on a case, and that certainly would apply to the Carroll cases as well as the fraud case. I think Trump will push forward on the cases against media and media operatives, and I think he'll try to add to them. And frankly, I think he'll try to add a criminal element.
I think that he'll also use his leverage with Congress to push back against the media. In fact, I think I read something recently that Representative Taylor Greene in Georgia is, you know, now heading a new committee where there are threats to defund NPR, and really troubling.
Let me make that clear. There are serious threats. It was part of the Project 2025, and there are serious threats to eliminate funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting receives federal money, and then the Corporation for Public Broadcasting gives that money to National Public Radio and PBS, the public broadcasting system. Mm-hmm. So the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is in severe jeopardy at this point. And that's going to be another way that media is going to be attacked.
Correct. Because if that funding can't be or won't be replaced with private donations, then you know, there's going to be a clear diminution of public media, public radio, public television. And that, I think, begins kind of that process of kind of even taking over messaging nationwide.
And right now, I can tell you that my colleagues in public broadcasting are all deciding if they lose their Corporation for Public Broadcasting money that comes to them, how can they survive? And how do they cut back services? And what happens to public media across the nation? It's a major problem when that's happening along with and at the same time, commercial media is suffering, whether it's cable news, whether it's network news, and certainly newspapers that are just dying by the droves across the country. It's a real problem. It is a real problem, subject to another discussion on another show. So, Judge, I think we've rounded up every case that's out there, and I hope that we've given our listeners an update. And I want to thank them for listening to us today as we've gone through all of these and given our point of view and hopefully interpreted them for us. If people like what they hear, how do they find us?
Well, we can be found on every major platform where you get your favorite podcasts. We invite you to please check out Next Witness, Please. We are really grateful, deeply grateful to our primary host and sponsor, that being NPR, National Public Radio.
For now.
But we can also be found on every other podcast platform that you can access, including Amazon, Spotify, Apple. All of these platforms are major platforms, and we look forward to you tuning in to us to listen to these episodes that we have specifically curated based on your interest and the interests of the country in general. And so we hold true to the belief that you don't trust what you don't understand. And our goal is to help you to understand this process and, by extension, earning your trust. Thank you.
If you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can email it to me. My email address is Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. If you have topics you'd like for us to cover in the future, you can also shoot us an email. Next Witness, Please is produced through the auspices of WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and our audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you some more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.